Whoever you are, wherever you come from, whoever you love, we welcome you. My name is Saul Flanner. I'm joined this morning by my spouse, Kathy Walker, in leading today's lay-led service. Lay-led services are a time-honored Unitarian Universalist tradition. We believe the Sunday service is best reflected in a variety of voices and experiences. We are glad to have you with us this morning. We hope you find something in the service today that nourishes your spirit and helps you find and keep your balance.
Our chalice lighting this morning is from a 2009 sermon by Reverend Greg Ward, There When You Need Us. A child is out walking with his father. Seeing a large stone in their path, the child is eager to prove his might and move the heavy stone out of the way. He runs toward the stone, throwing himself against it with all his might while his father looks on. The young boy pushes and he pulls. He leans his back into it and pushes until his face turns red, but he is just not strong enough. Finally, frustrated, he slumps to the ground. "I can't do it. It's impossible," he says. His father smiles and says in a quiet voice, "It's not impossible. You could do it if you could figure out how to give it everything you have." The little boy feels defensive. He argues that he did give it everything he had. His father listens and shakes his head. "How could you have given it everything you had? You haven't asked for my help yet." This morning, we light our chalice to recognize those friends and family members who remind us the impossible is sometimes possible with just a little help from the ones we love. Just over a year ago, Saul and I met our daughter, Kailani Song Lee, in China. She was 10 months old. On September 5th, she will turn 2. I recently took our almost 2-year-old on a walk, or rather, she took me on a walk. As best I could, I followed Kailani's lead, trying not to intervene in her explorations as we traveled the distance of one city block and back again. This journey took us 40 minutes. Later that night, I related the experience on Facebook, noting her observations of acorns, bees, and ants, describing her relationship with Tomater, her favorite push car, and identifying several of the signs and gestures she used to communicate her thoughts to me as we walked together. If you've never gone on a walk with a toddler, I highly recommend doing so. It's a little surreal. Time slows down. Perspectives shift. A toddler will stare at the most mundane views as if they're the rarest of vistas, privy only to a deserving few. What are toddlers seeing as they slow to a stop, focus their vision, and point ever so carefully at a blade of grass, a single rock, a tiny bump on a stick? How much do we miss as adults up here in a hurry? Seeing the world through a toddler's eyes can take your breath away. Witness the toddler's wonder. Mouth agape with joy, she picks up a berry she's found on the sidewalk, delighted to share her discovery with you. She squeezes it between her fingers. Her eyes widen as the juices bleed down her arm. She hands you the remaining pulpy flesh, implicitly asking you to embrace her joy. Do it. Take the berry and run it between your fingers. Better yet, pick up another one and squeeze it yourself. Laugh with delight. Breathe in its scent. Breathe out your own wonder. When was the last time you felt like this? Come, let us worship together. Our first reading is from The Kissing Hand by Audrey Penn. Chester Raccoon stood at the edge of the forest and cried,
"I don't want to go to school. I want to stay home with you. I want to play with my friends and play with my toys and read my books and swing on my swing. Please, may I stay home with you?"
Mrs. Raccoon took Chester by the hand and nuzzled him on the ear. Sometimes we all have to do things we don't want to do, even if they seem strange and scary at first. But you will love school once you start. You'll make new friends and play with new toys, read new books, and swing on new swings. "Besides," she added, "I know a wonderful secret that will make your nights at school seem as warm and cozy as your days at home." Chester wiped away his tears and looked interested.
A secret? What kind of secret?
A very old secret, said Mrs. Raccoon. I learned it from my mother, and she learned it from hers. It's called the kissing hand.
The kissing hand? What's that?
I'll show you. Mrs. Raccoon took Chester's left hand and spread open his tiny fingers into a fan. Leaning forward, she kissed Chester right in the middle of his palm. Chester felt his mother's kiss rush from his hand, up his arm, and into his heart. Even his silky black mask tingled with a special warmth. Mrs. Raccoon smiled. Now, whenever you feel lonely and need a little loving from home, just press your hand to your cheek and think, Mommy loves you, Mommy loves you. And that very kiss will jump to your face and fill you with toasty warm thoughts. She took Chester's hand and carefully wrapped his fingers around the kiss. Now, do be careful not to lose it, she teased him. But don't worry, when you open your hand to wash your food, I promise the kiss will stick. Chester loved his kissing hand. Now he knew his mother's love would go with him wherever he went, even to school. That night, Chester stood in front of his school and looked thoughtful. Suddenly, he turned to his mother and grinned.
Give me your hand.
Chester took his mother's hand in his own and unfolded her large, familiar fingers into a fan. Next, he leaned forward and kissed the center of her hand. Now you have a kissing hand, too. And with a gentle goodbye and I love you, Chester turned and danced away. Mrs. Raccoon watched Chester scamper across a tree limb and enter school. And as the hoot owl rang in the new school year, she pressed her left hand to her cheek and smiled. The warmth of Chester's kiss filled her heart with special words. Chester loves you, it sang. Chester loves you. Our second reading is an excerpt from The Daddy Shift by Jeremy Adam Smith. In 2004, my son Liko was born. Everything, the tree outside the window, the dreams I had at night, changed. For the first year of his life, my wife Ollie stayed home with Liko. Then she went back to work and I quit my job, joining the ranks of caregiving dads. Now it was just the two of us boys, and it was scary. Liko, a confirmed breast addict, could not nap without his mother. When I would lay him down, he'd wail inconsolably, relentlessly reaching out to me. But when I picked him up, he'd kick and arch his back, his little hands pushing against my chest. This would go on for hours. I'd put him in the stroller and walk. He'd cry and fall asleep, but if I stopped in a bookstore, a coffee shop, he'd wake and cry again. So I soon learned to keep moving through our San Francisco neighborhood, sticking to the side streets, going up the hills, down, up, and down. Time slowed, and with every minute, I'd feel more and more isolated, more and more anxious. I wondered, is my life now no more than this? I'd see people laughing in a picture window and want to be one of them. In time, I learned to let that go, let myself get lost. On foggy days, the hills of the city floated around us like deserted islands, the stroller a lonely raft. I'd study the cornices and gables on the Victorian facades, watch the tsunami of fog spill over Twin Peaks. Later, Liko learned to fall asleep in my arms. I'd carry him through all the rooms in our apartment, stepping carefully around the bouncy seat, the swing, the baby gym, the high chair, the toy basket. I'd do this for hours. Then one momentous day, I sat down in a rocking chair and he stayed asleep. I took a book down from the bookshelf. It was the best book I'd ever read. I don't remember its name. One afternoon, as the room darkened, his eyes snapped open and they met mine. He smiled and said, Dada, and his small fingers curled around my forefinger. He was glad to see me there with him, and I was glad to be there. It is strange to think that such an intensely private moment might be the product of a tectonic shift in society and the economy. Stay-at-home dads are the leading edge of this shift, pioneers who are quietly mapping new territory for all fathers. And if this map has a destination, it is a world in which gender roles are more flexible and the division of family labor is negotiated, not imposed. Something new must emerge, and it is emerging. A tricky, momentous change that is already happening on playgrounds and in living rooms, in countless casual exchanges and public debates, and in the most private moments between dads and their kids. woods, when the child's eyes open and see dad in a way that the sons and daughters of earlier generations often never could.
Today is the zombie apocalypse. What skills will you bring to the table? But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me back up a little bit. In July of 2008, I led a service entitled Confessions of a Copy Store Jesus, in which I observed that each of us in our day-to-day lives are in a constant state of ministry to others, whether we realize it or not. When we really set our minds to it, when we truly minister to people, we have the opportunity to do so in a way that has real meaning, both for them and for us. Like many people, my job has always been a big part of my identity. Of course, it didn't hurt that I had a job I loved and was good at. But last year, we brought our daughter home from China, and my career underwent a drastic transformation. I went from retail copy store clerk to stay-at-home dad. Quite a shift. Back when I worked in retail, giving good customer service was kind of a big deal. I'm not saying it was for everyone, but it was for me. A great deal of the personal satisfaction I derived from my job was centered on trying to live up to the company pledge to make every customer experience outstanding. I didn't always succeed, but when I did, it felt good. And when I didn't, I usually left work feeling disappointed in myself. But nowadays, my customer base is drastically narrowed. Basically, my core customer base is one. And as customers go, she is very vocal, which is both good and bad. You always know where you stand with Kailani. If she's happy with the way things are going, it shows on her face. And if she's unhappy or dissatisfied, you know that too. No customer comment card needed. I don't believe Jesus was the Son of God, but I do believe he was a great spiritual teacher. And I also believe that we all have a little bit of Jesus inside us. Those who attended our 2008 service were introduced to a whole host of characters, including but not limited to nursery teacher Jesus, school psychologist Jesus, AIDS educator Jesus, and banjo playing Jesus. All of these people, people you may know and love, have the opportunity in their day-to-day jobs to minister to others in a way that would make Jesus proud. And so do you, and so do I. And that's what I talked about in this pulpit 4 years ago. But if I truly want to embrace my newfound family responsibilities as my job, my profession, and if I truly believe my job is a ministry and that emulating Jesus' ministry to the best of my ability is something I aspire to, it begs the question, exactly what does stay-at-home Jesus look like? You know, it's funny, the stuff I worried about before we brought Kailani home. Will I be able to tell when her diaper is wet? Will I be able to rock her to sleep? What will she eat? What if she won't eat? What if she eats and then throws up? I was a 42-year-old man who, to the best of my recollection, had never changed a diaper in his life. And I was terrified. Turns out, that was the easy stuff. Once I figured out how to mix the formula the way they did at the orphanage, she took to it right away. Diapers, especially the super messy ones, could be a little tricky, but it turns out you get lots of practice. The first time she projectile vomited on me, it was a shocker, but you get over it and you move on. So yeah, her physical needs, no sweat, done, in the bag. What snuck up on me the most was the other stuff, the harder stuff, like patience. I used to think I was a pretty patient guy. My supply of patience was inexhaustible. I could weather any storm, tolerate any amount of resistance or dawdling, perform repetitive tasks cheerfully with enthusiasm from now until the end of time, or so I thought. Being a first-time parent has a way of forcing you to reevaluate everything you thought you knew about yourself. Kailani is strong-willed. She is a strong-willed 23-month-old who is already testing the boundaries and the patience of her unsuspecting but well-meaning father. Kathy and I, like many parents of young children who live on busy streets, have a rule about being outside in the front yard. Kailani is supposed to stay between the sidewalk and the house, or on the sidewalk itself, where she takes great pleasure in pushing her plastic tomato car back and forth and back and forth. She is not allowed to go past the sidewalk onto the easement, and she knows this. But like all of us, she sometimes needs a reminder. When we remind her of this rule, she sometimes responds by standing on the sidewalk and slowly easing just one foot into the forbidden zone. Alternately, she might walk as close to the grass as possible, so close that she occasionally steps over accidentally. Or she might try bouncing a ball into the easement area, then looking back at us as it actually slowly moves towards the ball. In my head, I know this kind of pushback is both healthy and age-appropriate. In my head. But I really wasn't prepared for my own emotional response to this kind of willful behavior. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes, it makes me so mad I could just spit. And then suddenly I find myself in a battle of wills with a not quite 2-year-old who weighs somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 pounds, and I will not be defied, God damn it. And so I'm trying to learn patience, to increase my inexhaustible reserves. And just like with changing diapers, I'm getting a lot of practice. I'm trying to remember when she pushes or oversteps the boundaries I've set for her. Kailani isn't acting out of spite, but out of an instinctive need to figure out exactly what the rules are and how her desires mesh or conflict with mine. Essentially, she's learning how to negotiate our relationship, and I'm teaching her by my example. Jesus had a little something to say about treating others the way we would like to be treated ourselves. I think it's one of the basic requirements of being in right relationship with others. That's a term I had never really heard before becoming a UU, right relationship. Apparently, it's originally a Quaker term. I don't pretend to be an expert on the principles of Quakerism. I just like the sound of it, right relationship. The idea that every relationship in our lives is important enough that we should want it to be the best it can possibly be. We should want it to be right. We should want the way we behave to be an example of the kind of behaviors we value and celebrate in others. The lessons Kailani learns from me about being in right relationship will eventually help to form the foundation for every significant relationship in her life. No pressure, right? So I'm trying to be less reactionary, to be more patient, to be more loving and more honest, both with myself and with her, about how her actions make me feel. And even though she doesn't understand everything I'm saying yet, I hope she'll understand enough to realize that Daddy has feelings too. It may take a while, but that's okay, because I've still got a lot to learn, like about humility. Because I can admit it, I may have been a little judgmental of other parents in the past. When I saw them in public places like Target or the grocery store, or even in church, yelling at their kid for some seemingly tiny infraction, come on, give the kid a break. He's just a kid, right? If I was that kid's parent, I would never speak to them like that. But I understand a little better now. I'm starting to realize that I don't always see the whole story. Maybe I didn't see the 25 different stress-inducing interactions that particular parent and child have had between the parking lot and the checkout line. I didn't see the hundreds of tiny rebellions, the litany of endless boundary pushing and limit seeking hour after hour, day after day, that has pushed that parent to their breaking point. I'm not saying that parents don't ever cross the line. I'm not trying to say that actual abuse is ever justified. I'm just saying I'm a little more likely to give the parent in the grocery store the benefit of the doubt. So for every raised eyebrow or disapproving glance or snide remark whispered in the back of my mind, I apologize. And if my judgmental demeanor was more obvious than I thought, and that in turn actually made things worse by adding to that other parent's stress levels, I apologize for that too. Jesus reminds us to judge not, lest ye be judged. Or more specifically, whatever standard we use to judge others, we shall be judged by that same standard. He was right. I now know what it's like to feel like your parenting skills, perhaps even your worthiness to parent in the first place, are being constantly judged. And I know what it's like to feel like I've come up short. And even though I know this judgment is largely self-imposed, that doesn't make it any easier to stomach. And that's how I know I've still got a lot to learn, like how to cut myself some slack. When I first quit my job, I had a lot of expectations for this next great phase in my life. Not only was I going to be super dad, raising a happy, healthy, well-adjusted toddler, I was going to be super spouse and super homemaker, too. I was going to have the dishes done, the laundry washed and folded, the beds made, the groceries put away, and dinner on the table when Kathy got home from work. In addition, I had a whole list of home improvement projects I was going to try to tackle in my free time. 1 year later, the beds remain unmade, Kathy still does the majority of the dishes and laundry, and my project list remains essentially untouched. And even though I'm smart enough to know that TV shows like Leave It to Beaver don't really reflect reality for the majority of American families, it still took me quite a bit of failing and beating up on myself before I finally realized that my expectations were as unrealistic as they were outdated. I guess I mostly blame my mom, who always seemed to have it all together, despite raising two kids instead of just one, and working to put my dad through medical school at the same time. Over the phone this week, she thanked me for the compliment, then went on to assure me she didn't always have it as together as it might have appeared. She says there was always a mad scramble to get the house looking presentable before guests came over, and my brother and I sometimes helped out. I am skeptical of this. I certainly don't remember being particularly helpful. She said there would come a point, usually about 30 minutes before the guests were to arrive, when she would tell herself, if I haven't gotten it done by now, it's not going to get done. Then she could relax and focus on enjoying the visit. So I guess that's what I'm going to have to start doing, reminding myself that as long as Kailani has clean clothes to wear and food to eat and a roof over her head, everything's probably going to be okay. It's time to relax my own standards a bit, to give myself the same benefit of the doubt I've decided to give those parents in the grocery store. Forgive myself for not being perfect and breathe. That's pretty good advice, even if it's easier advice to give than receive. And I found myself giving it a lot lately. It's one of the things we try to tell Kailani when she's in the middle of throwing a tantrum. Kailani, shh, take a deep breath. And to her credit, she tries, even if the breath she ends up taking is more of a trembling, jerky, heartbreaking spasm, she tries. She's actually had a lot to cry about lately, as we've had to confront her increasingly alarming levels of separation anxiety. Most children experience separation anxiety, but it's generally agreed that kids who have been institutionalized are prone to increased anxiety regarding parental absences. And as adoptive parents who are very aware of the challenges facing children who fail to form secure attachments, we find ourselves suddenly having to switch gears from the super nurturing strategy we've been practicing to something a little less hands-on. With the help of our friends, our family, and our community, we're working hard to help her through this rough period, to teach her she doesn't always need one of us present to feel safe, that scratching herself is not an acceptable way to express her anxiety, that Daddy always comes back, always. And things do seem to be looking up. This fall, she'll begin attending Happy Day School twice a week, and we've been working closely with her teacher and the school psychologist to help ease her transition. In addition, after switching midstream from hearing only Cantonese to hearing only English, Kailani has some understandable speech delays when compared with other children her age. This is probably more worrisome for us than it is for her, but it can be frustrating for all of us when she can't communicate her desires to us. This, too, is getting better, and Kailani has recently increased her spoken vocabulary from just a couple of words to almost a dozen. None of this helps my anxiety levels, of course. We knew going in that all post-institutionalized kids are, to one degree or another, kids with special needs. But it's impossible to tell how exactly those needs will manifest for her down the line. So I worry a lot. I worry she'll never be able to stop crying when Daddy leaves the room. Then I worry she will. I worry the attachment we've built with her over the past year won't be strong enough. Then I worry it's too strong, that she'll never be able to function independently. I worry her speech delays will continue, that she'll lag behind in school, that language is something she'll always struggle with. I worry I'm not giving her the tools she'll need to properly navigate a society that will treat her differently because of the color of her skin or the shape of her eyes. I worry because that's what parents do. But when I'm feeling out of my depth, there's another important lesson I tend to overlook, that it's okay to ask for help. From your parents, your brother, your spouse, your friends, your school psychologist, your early intervention specialist, your child's teacher, your minister, your church. Because we all have resources at our disposal, and we owe it to the people who depend on us to give it everything we have. And what we have right here in this room and in all of our neighborhoods and schools and in this beloved city we call Kent is community. And that's one of the things I've been truly grateful for lately. On June 3rd, I posted the following status update to Facebook. Saul Flanner is feeling a lot of love right now for his church community, for his spouse, for his daughter, and for his life. Now, anybody who knows me knows that I'm already a pretty touchy-feely kind of guy. But Kailani has opened my eyes to an entirely new level of love, and in ways I couldn't have imagined. A lot of people think that once you become a parent, your social life is pretty much over, and in some ways they're right. I prefer to think that my social life, rather than dying, has been transformed. It's true I can't do a lot of the things I used to do, like stay up all night playing video games or go to a movie at the drop of a hat. But that's because the focus of my social agenda has changed. It's not just about me anymore. Now my social agenda is more about making playdates and going to restaurants and events that are family-friendly and doing things that are going to be entertaining and engaging for Kailani and that are going to offer me a clear exit strategy in the event of a temper tantrum or a diaper blowout. But this transformation has opened up some exciting new opportunities for me as well, a chance to enlarge my social circle, a chance to get to know and connect with people in ways I haven't before. Some of these people are people I've known for a long time, but seeing them interact with Kailani sheds a whole new light on the kind of loving people they are and reminds me there's a reason I'm friends with them. You may think you know someone, but until you've done a silly song and dance routine with them in an effort to make a 2-year-old giggle, you haven't seen into the depth of their soul. Kathy, my brother Ross, my other brother Kai, and myself have had a pretty comfortable coexistence here in Ohio for the last 10 years or so. Then Kailani came along, and then we were 5. But Kailani has expanded our family in other ways as well. When our friend Dana agreed to take home and detag and wash every single piece of clothing we received at our baby shower, which was a lot of clothes, we were grateful, but we had no idea 5 months later she would become an even bigger part of our expanding family. When our friend Liz agreed to house sit for us while we were in China, we did not predict that she too would soon be joining our comfortable little foursome. Now that my brothers both have girlfriends, we've taken to calling ourselves the six-pack. When Kailani is with us, which is pretty much always, we are the six-pack and a bag of chips. I can't give Kailani complete credit for the matchmaking, but I'm pretty sure seeing Ross and Kai in the role of loving uncle didn't hurt. Kailani has a way of helping us to find the joy in each other's company, just as she encourages us to find the joy in the world around us. And there's a lot of joy to be found. The joy of seeing her take her first steps, then toddling, then running. The joy of her face as a lightning bug lands on her hand. The joy of watching the wheels turn in her head as she learns and discovers new things. The joy of traveling across the country, stopping at every rest area so she can run and jump and splash in every puddle. The joy of introducing her to her grandparents and great-grandparents. The joy of introducing her to Star Wars and comic books and other bastions of geek culture. The joy of hearing her squeal with laughter as I chase her around the room pretending to be a zombie. Which reminds me, today is the zombie apocalypse. My friends and I have a little game we like to play. In this game, zombies have taken over the world. We imagine we are a ragtag group of survivors. And it's our job to recruit other survivors to join our group. But we can only take so many people with us. So we have to choose people from among our friends and acquaintances who have personalities and skill sets that will complement the rest of the group and help to ensure our survival. What skills do you bring to the table? Now, the primary conceit of this game is this. Everyone in the room is already a member of the group, so we're never put in the position of having to look across the table and say, I want you on my team, or you, not so much. Which is a good thing, because I'm pretty sure I wouldn't make the cut. What skills would I bring to the table? My background in sculpture? My amateur photography skills? My years of experience in graphic design? I can't hotwire a car. I don't have any real survival skills. I'm certainly not a born leader. And I probably couldn't fire a gun if my life depended on it. So we were talking about this one day, and Liz suggested that in such a bleak scenario, it wouldn't be enough to know how to build a latrine or siphon gas or forage for food in the wilderness. People wouldn't just need to maintain their physical health. In a desolate world where everything they knew and loved was gone, they would desperately need to maintain their morale. She reminded me that when the two of us worked together, she had always seen me as a kind of peacemaker, one who seeks to build bridges, to make compromises, to heal the divisions between people. And as a UU, as a parent, as someone who professes to believe in the power of love, as someone who tries to honor the teachings of Jesus, it's hard for me to imagine a better compliment. In his famous and much shorter Sermon on the Mount, Jesus set forth a list of ideals called the Beatitudes that we should all strive to live by. So today, in his honor, and in an effort to give you something of substance to take home with you, I offer this. Blessed are those who are joyful, for they shall accumulate many treasures both for themselves and for others.
Blessed are those who open themselves to love, for their families shall expand exponentially.
Blessed are those who worry, but not too much. Blessed are those who ask for help, for they shall learn to trust in others.
Blessed are those who cut themselves some slack, for they shall not wither under their own scrutiny.
Blessed are those who are humble, for they shall see others more clearly.
Blessed are those who practice patience, for they shall dwell in right relationship with others.
And blessed are the peacemakers, and the banjo players, and the caregivers, and the nurturers, and those who labor on behalf of others, and those who laugh, for they shall not be left out in the cold during the zombie apocalypse.
Being married to stay-at-home Jesus has its privileges. Like that other Jesus, he's pretty forgiving and he's pretty good at sharing. Parenting a child with him is pretty fun too. For one thing, he really, really likes the voices I give to Kailani's animals and toys. Triceratops never fails to give Saul the giggles when she eats Kailani's hair.
Ooh, I like hair.
I enjoy making stay-at-home Jesus laugh. He makes me laugh too, and Kailani. Such tremendous joy to hear her squeals as she runs from her zombie Dada. Saul has long wanted to include an Amazing Grace House of the Rising Sun mashup in one of our services. And he was delighted when the geezers agreed. He also was pretty tickled when he discovered the theme song to Gilligan's Island had a similar lyric structure. He wasn't sure about the appropriateness of its inclusion, but the geezers assured him doing so would be consistent with their mission. And in their correspondence back and forth, Saul wrote, "I guess in their own way, they're all tales of woe and redemption and lost souls trying to find their way home." This made me laugh. "What are you trying to say, Saul? Is our tale one of woe and redemption? Are we just lost souls trying to find our way home?" Maybe that's everyone's story. Maybe that's what makes our ever so slightly self-indulgent services so important. Maybe we are all lost souls, but maybe here we are all home. "Now you have a kissing hand too," he told her, and with a gentle goodbye and an "I love you," Chester turned and danced away. May we all press hand to cheek and dance away today and every day. You are loved, you are loved. Go now in peace.